You're listening to the Dworkin Report, and I'm your host, Scott Dworkin. Today's podcast has a special guest, Mary L. Trump, whose best-selling book, Too Much and Never Enough, set sales records and revealed the inner world of the Trump family from the inside in a cogent narrative. Since then, Mary has been a highly sought-after news guest and commenter during the 2020 election, both for insight gleaned from experience and as a highly educated clinical psychologist. She was even one of Donald Trump's quote-unquote best people over two decades ago when he hired her to ghostwrite a book, then fired her. Little did Don know that Mary L. Trump would go on to become the most notable success as an author in the family, and certainly the most beloved one. This podcast episode veers off the beaten path of the standard questions people have asked her and goes into new territory about her family perpetrating a nearly billion-dollar swindle on her over which she has filed suit. Mary also shared insightful details about the crash landing of Donald Trump's closest sibling relationship and told us about her opinion of Trump's mishandling of the coronavirus crisis. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll learn a real inside perspective of what you're seeing play out on TV day after day inside the White House and in courtrooms across the country. Take a listen. I'm here with the author and clinical psychologist Mary L. Trump, whose Uncle Donald is running for re-election against Joe Biden right now. Thanks for taking the time for today's podcast. How are you, Mary?
Great, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Now, I know you're busy, obviously. It's a busy time of year, so let's dive right in. You wrote a viral tweet this week that I'm going to read in its entirety to our listeners, so I hope everybody can hold on for this time. Quote, unquote, actually, dot, dot, dot. So can you tell our listeners what it's like as the person, Mary, whose crazy uncle, who hired and fired, stole from her, is the president, and what's your takeaway from last week's dueling town halls?
Oh, man. Well, it's going to take a little longer to explain all of that than it did for me to type that tweet.
But, understood.
Yeah. Boy, it's still surreal watching all of this unfold. As far as the dueling town halls, I was deeply disturbed and angry that NBC chose to put Donald's appearance directly in competition with Vice President Biden's, because the debate wasn't canceled. Donald opted out because he's a coward. So it was just another instance of his getting rewarded for bad behavior. I didn't have a problem with their putting on a town hall, but I don't know why it couldn't have been at some other time.
It seems pretty intentional that it was meant to go ahead.
Cut into Biden's ratings, and, you know, I don't know how that worked out for them. Probably not well, but it also was a disservice. One, to Vice President Biden, because he had every intention of debating, but to the American people who had to make a choice.
Right.
I'm just not into, other than ratings, and, you know, I guess they're still in the tank for him. It was not at all clear to me what possible purpose it could have served.
How do you think he did?
I didn't watch it. I have a very difficult time watching him in real time.
Mm-hmm.
I need to kind of see it through the lens of Twitter or somebody else's commentary.
Mm-hmm.
From what I can tell, though, he didn't do well, and Savannah Guthrie did a good job of holding him to account for some things. But more would have been revealed in a debate, just because, well, I'm sorry, that's not entirely true. In a debate in which there's a mute button. Although I can't remember, I think it might have been Eric Bollert who said that, you know, because people were complaining that the first debate, we didn't learn anything and it was a disaster. And it was a disaster, but Eric Bollert was right when he said that we learned a lot. We learned a lot about who Donald is and we learned a lot about who Joe Biden is.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the town hall was more of the same. I got the sense that he was a jerk. And I mean, not that that's unexpected, but that he can't handle being questioned.
Right. Right. Especially open-ended questions where he has to fill in the gaps and not use catchphrases or slogans or, you know, inflammatory language and has to actually explain things. He did not do that during the interview, and he definitely was confronted by Savannah Guthrie multiple times. There's still some questions. You know, she straight up asked him, who do you owe $421 million to? And then he ignored it and moved on or whatever. But
didn't he say that's not a lot of money to owe somebody?
He did.
Remember when Mitt Romney got taken to the woodshed for saying to somebody he was debating, I bet you $10,000, whatever.
Right.
That because he was such an out of touch elitist. And now here's Donald, who probably doesn't have 10 bucks in the bank, saying $410 million isn't a lot of money.
Not Bigfoot and aristocrat like me.
He's such a man of the people.
Exactly. Your book is obviously a smash with the Simon & Schuster. It details the Trump family history and the values that your aunts and uncles shared. With that in mind, as a clinical psychologist who understands the relationship between public health and mass communications, how would you describe Donald's response to the coronavirus, focusing on detection and initial response, his messaging, and his on and off slash ongoing COVID-19 relief bill negotiations?
It's criminal. It's abjectly criminal. What he hasn't done, what he hasn't acknowledged, what he has done, how he's manipulated data, he's manipulated the science, he's manipulated governors, he's held necessary equipment hostage if his ass doesn't get sufficiently kissed. And more egregiously, he's downplayed it to the point where a significant minority of people in this country refuse to believe that it's something to be taken seriously. And he's directly responsible for the deaths of over 210,000 people.
That's quite the response. I agree with what you've said there. Are you surprised that your uncle had his own battle with COVID-19? And what's your opinion of how he handled that and the impact of his public perception from that?
I was surprised it took him so long to get sick, because he's put himself at risk so recklessly from the beginning, because, of course, he has to prove that he's a tough guy and impervious to illness. What I worried about and have thought for a long time is that the worst possible scenario would be if he got COVID-19, but either had a mild case or a moderate case from which he recovered quickly. And that's exactly what happened. And the reason I thought that that was going to be disastrous because of what he did afterwards, telling people that they should not let COVID-19 dominate their lives, that, you know, if you're tough enough like he is, you can beat it, which is not just a lie and insane, it's also just disgracefully disrespectful to people who have died and their loved ones. So he essentially felt like he was given permission to double down on, you know, it's not a big deal, we need to open up, and if you think otherwise, and if you wear a mask and think we still need to social distance, you're just, you know, a liberal wimp, or, you know, not really a man. It's just extraordinary. But there you have it. And it's easy to forget this sometimes, but there are still people in this country who believe they're leaders, because we're sort of raised to, right? Mm-hmm. So if the people that you put your trust in with your vote, whether it's your congressperson or your governor or your senator or the person in the Oval Office, and they're telling you to trust them and not believe the science, that's what a lot of people are going to do. And it's devastating.
It is. And it's tough politicizing masks and things like that. It's been tough. We actually started our own organization called Masks Now. It's delivered hundreds of thousands of masks to people. but it exists only because there were no masks being given out. It's just so disheartening to see, because the president's words do matter, and it seems like fear is how people survive. So like when he says, don't be afraid of it, it's just, mm-hmm. and that's weak. It just, you know, it makes my body, ugh. It's,
Well, and it's also, it's just cravenly opportunistic, because most of the time he's perfectly happy to keep people terrified with the hordes and the caravans and, you know, all of the other fictional crises he gins up to keep people afraid and angry. So it's because it suits his purposes in this particular instance for that not to be the case. It also is another way to just divide all of us.
Well, let's switch gears now and dive deeper into the events described in your book, Too Much and Never Enough. I know that you recently filed suit against Donald, his siblings, your aunts, and against the state of your recently departed Uncle Robert. May he rest in peace. Can you start by telling me how much, in rough dollar terms, you think Donald and the others may have cheated you and your brother out of your grandfather's estate? And what does it feel like to join the list of thousands of litigants, multiple state and federal law enforcement agencies, either investigating or litigating with the Trump Organization?
Yeah, I feel sort of passe. Oh, another lawsuit against Donald. I'm unlike everybody else in my family. Well, not everybody else, but certainly unlike Donald. I am not a litigious person. But, you know, part of the reason the lawsuit's a good thing is because it helps answer the question for people who, accuse me of writing the book for money. No, I did not write the book for money. That's what the lawsuit's about, you know, because I would appreciate having my stolen property returned to me. It's necessary. I found out, you know, thanks to the extraordinary reporting by Suzanne Craig and Russ Buettner that was published 2 years ago, that my family had committed a fraud against me. And I'm not entirely sure why I shouldn't try to right that wrong. You know, when people say it's revenge, no, it's justice. How is it revenge? You know, they shouldn't have defrauded their niece and their dead brother's child. That's simple. In terms of dollar amounts, I don't really know, but let's put it this way. When my grandfather died, when we got to the end of the lawsuit, because I had sued the estate thinking that I had been improperly disinherited, which, as it turns out, was not the case. When we decided to settle, they also had to buy me out of my share of a partnership I had belonged in since my father died. So that's what this lawsuit is about. That, you know, they undervalued the assets that I owned. But in order to come to a number, they needed to give us an accounting. And we were told that my grandfather's estate at the time of his death was worth $30 million. It turns out it was actually worth $1 billion.
Wow.
So, you know, that should give you some sense of, yeah, because if my partnership was a share of $30 million, then that's one number. And if it's a share of $1 billion, that's another number entirely.
Is there anything you didn't put in your book or you recall now that you wish you could share with people right now, an anecdote, a specific scheme you uncovered or something along those lines?
Now, when I wrote this book, I knew that the only way it was going to work. Actually, let me rephrase that, because that's not true. I was told. Like, I was very reluctant to write about certain things. But a good friend of mine said, you have one shot at this. You need to lay it all on the table. You need to swing for the fences, or whatever, you know, poker/sports metaphor you want to come up with. So that's what I did. I put it all out there. And I think that was the right move. You know, there's certain things that didn't make it into the book because they were for editorial reasons. But most of those had to do with my dad. So no, I put everything in there because I wanted people to have as much information as possible.
Have you gotten any threats as a result of the publication of your book besides the actual lawsuits that your uncle filed against you for releasing it? And is that over now, by the way?
This is a commentary on where we are as a country in the 21st century, but I'm actually shocked to report that I have not received any threats. I don't know why. I'm not complaining. But you know, when the book was published, I took appropriate cautions.
Mm-hmm.
Because I fully expected that there would be problems. I have people like searching the dark web just to be on the safe side. No threats. I've gotten, you know, I had some things sent to my house, not things, cards sent to my house, just say, you know, telling me what a horrible person I was and what an alcoholic loser my dad was, but nothing threatening. Even on Twitter, it's sort of the same three or four attacks. You know, you're a grifter, you just want revenge. When are your 15 minutes going to be up? You know, but no threats.
One of the most evocative stories in your book was about your dearly deceased Uncle Robert, who had a fondness for cream cheese and coercion. Can you explain to our listeners how the two brothers' business relationship came to a halt during the manic 80s and subsequent 90s crash, and how that's relevant to the presidency and election?
From my understanding, this is information I have from, you know, other people in the family, so there's no reason for me not to believe it. And also, I was around enough at the time to understand that things were all was not well. In the late 80s, Rob went to work for Donald at, I think, Trump Castle, one of the casinos in Atlantic City. And it was a really bad time because Donald had decided to open a third casino, which essentially put all three of his Atlantic City properties in competition with us, with each other. And the Taj, which had just an insanely high debt service, cannibalized the profits of the other two casinos, which had been doing fairly well, including the one Donald was running. So, of course, Donald, who never takes responsibility for anything, blamed Robert. And whether it was Robert's fault or not, I don't know. But whatever the case, they had a knockdown, drag-out fight. And my understanding is that Rob was fired. But, you know, I don't have documentary proof of that. I don't have any reason to disbelieve it, but, you know, I can't prove it. And that, you know, they hated each other for quite some time. And as far as I know, it wasn't until Donald started running in 2015 that Donald hopped on the bandwagon because I guess he thought it could be useful. And then he went all in. He became a Fox-watching, evangelical-loving, you know, pro-Donald sycophant.
Well, I guess that happens once in a while to some people. They get sucked in the whirlpool.
Yeah, or you know, they're willing to be opportunistic.
Truth. We have, for my last question, we're 2 weeks away from Election Day 2020. That's only 14 days. Last time I checked, 323 hours. not that I'm counting.
Thanks. Thank you. Now, guess what I'm going to be doing every hour.
That's the countdown. Let the countdown begin. Tell me, what would you say as the only family member of Trump's of the Trump family to go public speaking directly to someone who's an undecided voter right now?
First of all, how is that even possible? But okay, let's assume for this. You know what? I'm going to the way I interpret undecided is not they don't know which person to vote for. They don't know whether or not they're going to vote.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, those are the people. If they are going to listen to me at all, I would speak to, and I would say that I understand completely why some people don't have faith in the system. I understand why people feel that they've been completely left out of the conversation, because they have been. And I also understand why people aren't willing to overcome the obstacles of voting, because, you know, a lot of privileged white people don't seem to understand that just because it takes you 2 minutes to vote doesn't mean that's the case for everybody. And a lot of people may not be able to wait in line for 10 hours to cast a vote in what's supposed to be a great democracy. So I would say, and I know this takes a leap of faith, that this time your vote really will count. And if we all stay focused on what matters, we actually can affect serious change going forward, because sometimes it takes hitting rock bottom to gather the fortitude to take a long, hard look at where we are and what needs to be done. You know, I've said in the past that if Joe Biden loses, it will be the end of American democracy. And that's just a really lazy shortcut. So I want to clarify what I mean. It will certainly be the end of the American experiment, which in my view is sort of this aspirational idea that there can be democracy for all people. And we have never achieved that. We never will. With four more years of Donald in the Oval Office, we will have hope of doing that if Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are elected. I would also add that, you know, the reason they don't want people to vote isn't because your vote doesn't count. It's because your vote is so powerful. And they know that.
If we all vote, I think we win as America in general.
That's absolutely right.
Well, Mary Trump, I appreciate your courage, and thank you for speaking out when so many people did not. I know it's probably tough to do and takes a lot of strength. So I appreciate your patriotism and everything you've done for this country, because it's gone a long way. Thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you so much. This was great.
I'd like to thank Mary L. Trump for joining me on the show. Thanks again to our producer, Grant Stern. You can follow him at Grant Stern. You can visit our website at dworkinreport.com for dozens of other episodes with fascinating people. Thanks for listening. Keep resisting.